A writer, for example, establishes the genre he works in, and you, the reader, agree to its terms. It's a contract between the two of you. A humorist promises to make you laugh. A thriller writer promises to create evil and then conquer it. A mystery writer promises to build a murderous maze and then show you the way out. A romance novelist promises to make you cry. You feel gypped when the author breaks the contract. It's the same with my audience. We have a contract binding us with an implicit promise. My promise is not merely to entertain the audience with beautiful bodies moving in space. That's the deal all dance audiences take for granted. My promise is to connect them to universal emotions and ancestral impulses through dance. That is why I struggle mightily at the start of any work to connect with roots and first causes and my most ancient memories. I can signal my intentions in many ways, even through the title. If I call a piece Surfer at the River Styx, the puzzled audience will at least get the hint that something ancient and mythic is happening on stage. You might not see your work this way. You might not struggle for spine. You might be content to receive any random thought floating through the ether that happens to settle on you that day. You might think you don't need a supporting mechanism for the art you're constructing, a controlling image, a collateral idea to guide you. You might think getting lost is a big part of the adventure. You may think that, but you'd be wrong. Floating spinelessly can get you through a day, but at some point, you'll be lost in the middle of a project, whether it's a painting, a novel, a song, or a poem, and you won't know how to get back to what you're trying to accomplish. It might not happen in your first creation, which in your bubble of sweet inexperience may skim from heart to mind to canvas, page, or stage exactly as you intended, perfect in shape, proportion, and meaning, in which case consider yourself blessed. But it will happen in the next piece, or the one after that. It happens to everyone. You'll find yourself pacing your particular white room, asking yourself, "What am I trying to say?" That is the moment when you will embrace with gratitude the notion of a spine. Keep in mind that coming up with a spine is neither a chore nor a distraction that takes you away from the real work of the creative process. It is a tool, a gift you give yourself to make your job easier. As for the particular quality of your spine, I'm not concerned with how you've developed it or how you exploit it. Your choice of spine is as personal as how you pray. It's a private choice that only has to provide comfort and guidance to you. It's your spine. Use what works for you. You can discover the spine of a piece in many ways. You can find it with the aid of a friend. That's what editors do for writers who have lost their way. It's the editor's job to challenge writers who are handing in stories with shaky narratives and lazy sentences. The question is always, what are you trying to say? In such cases, the editor is functioning as a chiropractor, bringing the spine back into proper alignment. You can induce it with a ritual. I know a lawyer who has a useful gambit when questioning his clients. Whenever he hears a muddled explanation, he holds up his hands to silence the speaker and says, "Okay, explain it to me as if I'm 10 years old." That simple instruction, perhaps because it floods people with memories of a simpler time, gets them talking with clarity and purpose. That's what the spine is to me. It's my explanation to myself as if I'm 10 years old again. You can also discover the spine by recalling your original intentions and clarifying your goals. What was the first thing you dropped into your box for the project? Go back to it and remember how you started. That's what it's there for. Make them laugh was the original impulse for an early piece of mine, 8 Jelly Rolls, set to the witty tunes of Jelly Roll Morton. Whenever I wavered in my intentions, I could always return to the home thought. Is it funny? Will they laugh? For a later piece, Baker's Dozen, my spine was a portrait of communities and how they function together positively. The key word is positively. In my mind, I kept the image of Edward Hicks's The Peaceable Kingdom, his famous painting of the beasts of the world together in blissful coexistence, lion beside ox, wolf next to lamb. That was the level of harmony I was aiming for. Whenever the piece, set to Willie the Lion Smith recordings, threatened to take a dark turn, I snapped it back to my sunny intentions. 12 dancers, representing an ideal society, not a tortured one. It must have worked. The audience always leaves grinning. For a later dance, 9 Sinatra songs, the spinal thought was the life of a married couple from beginning, infatuation and passion, to end, ongoing acceptance. The story was silent, told by 7 dancing couples. But the audience certainly picked up on it, cued in part by the lyrics of the songs. It became one of my biggest successes. Sometimes the spine does double duty, both as the covert idea guiding the artist and the overt theme for the audience. That's what makes Herman Melville's Moby Dick so powerful and enduring. It has a solid, unrelenting spine, get the whale. And that spine totally supports the novel's theme, obsession, get the whale. It is so clear and strong that readers stick with the book through all of Melville's detours into ivory carving and sail making and Atlantic weather patterns. They know the author's intentions, and they want to know if Ahab gets the whale. Sometimes the spine of a piece comes from the music I've chosen. For example, I love to create dances in the form of theme and variations. In many ways, this genre is a perfect blueprint for organizing a dance. Each new variation is my cue to change dancers or groupings or steps. It makes my job a lot easier if the music tells me where to end one section and begin another. Can you blame me for picking a form that gives me one less variable to worry about? As a result, I have gladly tackled the behemoths of the form. Brahms's Handel variation.